This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Okay, it's time for one of those statements of indisputable fact that you love so much. Almost nobody's eyesight gets better as they get older. There have been recent advances in eye care research that are helping more people keep their sight longer.
We like to screen you every 2 years, and then early treatment will prevent visual loss.
On today's health show, a talk about your eyes. We'll also learn how being born deaf affects your sense of touch, and we'll visit with a pain specialist who has some very good advice about concussions. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. As we get older, most of us experience major changes in our vision. The American Academy of Ophthalmology has recently released the results of several studies that will have an impact on the aging eye. I spoke recently about some of what is new in eye care with Dr. Ann Summers, a spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. We started by talking about glaucoma.
Yeah, glaucoma is an eye disease with no symptoms in its early stages, and it causes damage to the optic nerve and a very slow loss of peripheral vision. But you don't have any symptoms in the first even decade of glaucoma. The problem is the damage that's being done to your peripheral vision cannot be brought back, even with treatment. So the key to glaucoma is early diagnosis, early treatment, either with drops or we have this new mini drainage device, a surgical device that we can use to reduce the intraocular pressure. So there's all kinds of treatment that we can do, but we can't treat it if you don't come into the ophthalmologist and get evaluated and diagnosed. So early diagnosis, early treatment of glaucoma is key, and we see it in people over 50. So we like to see people for a complete screening at 40. And then if you have a tendency towards glaucoma or a family history or if you're African American or Hispanic, you're at a higher risk for the glaucoma. So we like to see you, screen you, make sure you don't have it, see you every 2 years, and then early treatment will prevent visual loss.
Well, I want to talk about that new treatment that we've heard of. It's kind of like a mini stent that is put in the eye to help drainage. Is that about right?
It's very exciting. At the annual meeting of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, they come out with new devices that are being used and tested and teaching all of us 32,000 ophthalmologists in the country about the new procedures that are on the horizon. Now, this is something new for glaucoma, and it's a stent. It's a small drain that you can put inside the eye. Now, ophthalmologists are medical doctors and eye surgeons, and we're used to putting things into the eye or lasering inside the eye or doing cataract surgery. And this is a nice, more predictable stent that we could use to reduce the intraocular pressure. Now, it's new. It's just on the horizon. Your doctor, in your neighborhood may not be using it next year, but maybe in 3 years or 5 years. And that's what I've seen in ophthalmology. I've been practicing now 25 years, is there's always something new in the treatment for glaucoma, the treatment for macular degeneration. There's exciting things that happen, and the field has changed in 20 years so remarkably that cataract surgery has gone from something that you had to do only if you had terrible vision and couldn't drive. Now, when people have trouble seeing their golf ball or maybe having little trouble with their computer, we bring people to cataract surgery much sooner because we know it's a predictable surgery. They're going to see better. It's same day outpatient surgery. It's just a better overall procedure for them. And same thing with glaucoma, that there's a lot of treatment that we can use in terms of drops for glaucoma that is much less stressful for the patient, easier for the patients to use, and more predictable results over the past 20 years.
And for the stents, we are talking about something that's new. There is only one that has been approved by the FDA, and there's still clinical trials going on around the states.
Absolutely. And there's also other kinds of mini stents that are out there that are being tested as well. There's several kinds of mini stents. The Hydrus mini stent was the one that was presented at the American Academy of Ophthalmology this last fall. But I think there'll be other devices as well.
Right. I want to take a quick left turn right here and go to something else that I've read about, and that is the new reading devices that seem to be helping people who have suffered with minimal vision loss to improve their reading speeds, like the Kindles and the iPads.
Well, this is really exciting because there are people with vision loss who, you know, when you come to the ophthalmologist, people come and they say, well, I'm not seeing well, I need new glasses. And sometimes they have cataracts and need surgery. Sometimes they have macular degeneration and they need treatment for that. But sometimes even with the best glasses and the treatment for their baseline eye disease, they still don't have 20/20 vision. And what this new research showed is that the digital tablets, and that would be the back-illuminated Kindles or the iPads, make reading easier, increase the reading speed for people with low vision. And this is a significant problem. By 2020, 43 million Americans are going to have vision loss from age-related eye diseases. Right now, it's already 3 million people who have poor vision, who even with the best glasses can't see. So this makes a gigantic difference for them. I have a 93-year-old patient who came in yesterday, and he was showing me he's using an iPad, and he feels like it's connected him back to the world, that now he can read his morning newspaper, he can go to his favorite websites. And, you know, at 93, he was a little intimidated by the electronic device. On the other hand, if you hand someone a connection to the world and say, now you can read and now you can see the news, it's a lifesaver. It's a wonderful thing. So it isn't for everyone, but it will make a huge difference in people with low vision. And it's the combination of both increasing the font size and the retroillumination, the back illuminated panel. It's the aging of the American population, and macular degeneration is very common in people in their 70s and 80s. Well, we have a lot more people now in their 70s and 80s. And then also it's the explosion of diabetes that's going on in America today. So that's really a message to all of your listeners who have diabetes. Very important to see their ophthalmologist, get a regular screening every year, because people with diabetes have an increased risk of visual loss from their diabetes. And then also know your family history. If you have a family history of glaucoma, you should get a screening for glaucoma, particularly if you're over 40. And as ophthalmologists, we do eye surgery and we fit glasses and contacts, but probably the most important thing we do is screen for eye disease, is to make sure that you don't have glaucoma or diabetic retinopathy or macular degeneration. And if you do have it, early treatment is the way to prevent visual loss.
That's Dr. Ann Summers, a spokesperson for the American Academy of Ophthalmology. You can learn more at geteyesmart.org.
I can see clearly now, the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's gonna be a bright sunshiny day. Gonna be bright sunshiny day.
Sight isn't the only one of the five senses we're going to talk about today. It appears that people who are born deaf process the sense of touch differently than people who are born with normal hearing. That's the finding of research funded by the National Institutes of Health. Wally Akinzo reports.
A recent study shows that since the auditory cortex of profoundly deaf people is not exposed to sound stimuli, it adapts and takes on additional sensory processing tasks.
In any scientific study, we're asking a specific question, and the question we were trying to answer is what happens to the hearing regions of the brain when a person is born deaf.
Dr. Christina Carnes is a NIH postdoctoral research associate in the Brain Development Lab at the University of Oregon.
The reason that we want to know the answer to this question is it tells us something about how the brain develops. We know that the basic instructions for how a brain is built is based on genes, but carrying out these instructions is highly influenced by experience. That tells us that brain development is plastic, meaning flexible and moldable, as opposed to sort of hard or brittle. And because the experience of someone who's born deaf is really different than the typical experience that can tell us how flexible is the brain development of the auditory system.
Deaf people may process vision using many different brain regions, especially auditory areas, including the primary auditory cortex. However, no one has tackled whether vision and touch together are processed differently in deaf people, primarily because in experimental settings, it's more difficult to produce the kind of precise tactile stimuli needed to answer this question. Dr. Carnes and her colleagues developed an apparatus that could be worn like headphones while subjects were in an MRI scanner.
So we scanned the brain of hearing people and people born profoundly deaf while they did a task in the MRI scanner. We compared the brain signal measures between these two groups. While the people were in the scanner, they do a task where they detect dim lights or feel gentle touches to the face. So we had to develop this kind of crazy headphone apparatus that they can wear inside this kind of tight tube. And the tubes deliver both air puffs, and then they have a little fiber optic cable that presents a dim light so that we could present touch and vision right at the same time, right in about the same place. Our volunteers ended up looking a bit like a cyborg wearing this headset with all these tubes kind of attached, aiming at their face, but it was pretty comfortable for them.
The researchers have been able to show that deaf people use the auditory cortex to process touch stimuli and visual stimuli to a much greater degree than occurs in hearing people.
And what we found was that in deaf participants, Heschel's gyrus, which is primary auditory cortex, had a much stronger response to touch and vision than in the hearing participants. So in hearing participants, just like you might expect, that part of the brain is specialized for hearing, and so it's not going to be as responsive to these other senses. But in the deaf people, the brain has reorganized or organized in a way that's not typical so that they're responding to these other senses. And in fact, the response to touch was about twice as strong as for vision, and touch and vision seem to interact with each other more in the deaf participants.
The study adds to a growing list of discoveries that confirm the impact of experiences and outside influences in molding the developing brain.
One of the really cool findings was that in some deaf participants, the way that touch and vision in auditory cortex interacted was so strong that a single flash of light appeared to be two flashes when it was paired with two air puffs. So feeling two touches made them think they saw two lights. And what was really cool was that those deaf participants with the largest response in the primary auditory cortex saw this illusion more often than others.
Dr. Carnes says there are several ways the finding may help deaf people.
We've learned something new about the deaf brain and how sensitive the hearing areas are to touch in the deaf and also to vision. And there's a lot more work to do, but this discovery might support the use of new approaches for the education of deaf people. The more that we know about the way that the brain might adapt, the better that we can tailor education and therapeutic interventions to deaf folks.
She adds that the primary auditory cortex in people who are profoundly deaf focuses on touch even more than vision. For more information on this study, visit nidcd.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso.
Still to come, but we've talked about the eyes and the ears. Let's keep things above the shoulders with a discussion about concussions. That's next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. You can start your own Health Show archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1295. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. With the Super Bowl just around the corner, we're going to be hearing a lot about the NFL's new policy on concussions. There was a time that the only way you were going to be diagnosed with a concussion is if you lost consciousness. That standard ended years ago, and today the dangerous signs of concussion are known and are actively being looked for on the playing field and in real life. Here to talk about those warning signs is Dr. Peter Abbaci, the co-founder and medical director of the Bay Area Pain and Wellness Center in San Francisco and a pain management expert on WebMD. Dr. Abbaci is also the author of Take Charge of Your Chronic Pain. We spoke recently and I asked what a parent should look for that might be a warning sign of concussion.
Well, certainly the most important warning sign is a headache, complaints of headaches. But other warning signs to look out for include nausea or feeling like they want to throw up, complaints of some blurry or hazy vision, feeling sensitive to the light, or what we call photosensitivity, another warning sign. If the child, you know, goes back to school the next day and they have a difficult time concentrating or remembering or learning things, if there's any signs or evidence of that either from the child or the teacher, that's certainly a warning sign. If you see any mood changes in your child or personality type changes or behavior that seems unusual for them, that's a potential warning sign. And if they report any problems sleeping at night, you know, that's another potential problem from a head injury.
What should be done if a child's found to have a concussion? Is there a treatment to do? Is it just sit them and let them rest and wait till things clear up?
Well, the main take home is when in doubt, sit them out. And the child needs rest, first and foremost. And, you know, that means rest from the sport or the physical activity or the exercise, but also it means rest from schoolwork, you know, brain rest. They may need to take a day or two off from school until symptoms start to get better. You don't want to send your child to class, you know, if they're not being able to concentrate or function mentally appropriately. So rest is the most important thing. And certainly if there are, you know, bad symptoms going on, if the child's really uncomfortable, you know, it never hurts to get it evaluated and, you know, see your pediatrician if possible or wherever's the quickest place to get checked. But also remember, a head injury and these types of problems, these sort of concussion problems or mild traumatic brain injury symptoms, they're not going to show up on a CT scan of the brain or anything like that. So that's why it's important for parents and coaches and teachers to understand what kind of signs and symptoms a child may report, because there's not necessarily a test you can go to the doctor and have done to make the diagnosis.
What happens long term if a concussion is left untreated, or this someone keeps going to play and keeps, you know, getting not necessarily banged in the head? Because we know you don't have to get banged in the head, right, to get a concussion.
That's correct. And the real concern comes along when there are repeated concussions. And so when they start to build up on each other, we know that that's where there's concern for long-term problems or side effects for the child or adult for that matter. So we know that's an issue. You know, we know that they don't necessarily have to have a direct head injury to develop concussive type symptoms. And certainly we see that with, for example, you know, military veterans coming back from the war who were exposed to, you know, being in the middle of battle and high-impact things happening, and the sort of rotational force or being, you know, swung around in a very forceful way can cause concussive symptoms within the brain.
Are we getting more sensitive towards concussions just as a society? Is it something that we're now paying a lot more attention to? And could that possibly be because of the injuries we're seeing coming back from the wars?
Well, that's exactly right. I think there's two things going on in the media that's bringing our attention back to this. Certainly the military veterans is a big one, and then the other big one is the NFL. And, you know, what we're seeing with some of the retired football players and some of the health problems that they're dealing with, and certainly the case of Junior Seau and his suicide from several months ago, you know, brought to light again, you know, the effects of repeated head injuries and how it can cause depression, you know, in his case, unfortunately leading to suicidality and then ultimately his tragic suicide. So we're definitely seeing high-profile people in the media who've been exposed to this, and this has been a bit of a wake-up call for the last few months and kind of looking at, gosh, where do these things begin? Well, they begin, you know, when they start playing you know, high school ball or Pop Warner, or when they had, you know, the bumps and bruises or whatever may have happened when they were kids. They estimate about 3.8 million people in the United States have head injuries per year, which is a fair amount. And interestingly, if you look at data on prisons, you know, anywhere to 65 to 75% of inmates, incarcerated people in prisons, have had a history of childhood head injuries. And what the correlation there is, I don't know for sure, but you know, it's a health problem, and it's good that we're recognizing it, and it's good that we're trying to start to do some things about it.
If someone were to come to you and say, well, you know, helmets and protective equipment have come so far in the past years, what would you say to them about those helmets and that protective equipment and concussions?
Well, definitely wear them. You know, if you're getting on a bike or a skateboard or playing your sport, and it's a sport where you're supposed to wear them, definitely wear them. You know, I can tell you, I had my own head bonk a couple weeks ago when I got propelled off my road bike and onto the pavement, and it happened so fast that I hit head first onto the pavement, and I had my helmet on, and if I didn't, I think I would have been seriously injured. And it was a freak thing where something got caught in the spokes of my front wheel, and it just flipped over right away. And you know, you never know, and you know, really should never have your children riding their bikes or skateboards or whatever things they like to tool around in. They should always have their helmets on.
If someone has their helmet on but does take a big hit to the head, there's still a good possibility of a concussion, though, right?
There is. Yeah, there is. And, you know, even me wearing my helmet with mine, I mean, my face was black and blue pretty good, and it stayed that way for about 3 weeks. And, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, you can go right back out on the football field. For example, if you had a significant head injury and you're having headaches or other symptoms after a blow to the head, you definitely need to not play football. Even if you're wearing your helmet and mouth guard and all that, you need to stay out of football, out of practice, out of the games until symptoms go away.
Can you see anything on the horizon where treatment or prevention of these might be, you know, there's something coming up that might be, you know, that helpful?
Well, interestingly, you know, the military, you know, as we talked about them being in the middle of dealing with the health effects of this, and I know that they've been experimenting with acupuncture and using acupuncture right at the, you know, at the battlefield level, you know, when people are getting injured, you know, out on the battlefield and they're getting picked up by the paramedics and immediately placing the acupuncture needles, you know, to treat things like head injuries like that, to reduce the incidence of it becoming a more of a chronic pain problem or more of a chronic disease problem for the injured soldier. So, you know, we're seeing some things like that, you know, which, of course, acupuncture has been around for about 5,000 years, but a new way of utilizing it.
Dr. Peter Abbaci is the co-founder and medical director of the Bay Area Pain and Wellness Center in San Francisco. He is also a pain management expert on WebMD. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Till then, stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.